Cold Steel, second in the Electrifying Steel series by JD Masters. For Jim Morris, who saw the possibilities, with special thanks to Jay Kennedy and Kevin Bishop. Chapter 1. The Army chopper came in low over the East River and landed on the helipad just below FDR Drive, about a mile south of the ruins of the 59th Street Bridge. Dev Cooper picked up his bags and stepped out through the hatch, ducking low to avoid the rotating blades. A car waited for him. The driver was a uniformed Marine sergeant in full dress blues. He wore a 9mm semi-automatic on his belt in a white flap holster. "Dr. Cooper," he said, approaching and snapping off a sharp salute. "Welcome to New York, sir." A civilian, Cooper did not know if he was expected to return the salute or not, and he would have felt awkward doing so in any case. Instead, he merely nodded and touched the brim of his chocolate-covered Stetson. The Marine dropped his salute. "Hope you had a nice flight from New Mexico, sir," the Marine said. "My name is Sergeant Coles. May I take your bag?" "Thank you, Sergeant," Cooper said in a soft Western drawl, relinquishing the suitcase. "Is that all you brought, sir?" "Yes, I like to travel light." "Best way to do it," Coles said, walking him back to the car. He opened the trunk and put the suitcase in, then opened up the rear door of the limo for him. "If you'd like to care for a drink to freshen up, sir, there's scotch, bourbon, vodka, rye, and Tennessee sour mash in the bar. You'll find ice in the compartment to the right, next to the glasses." "Appreciate it," Cooper said. "A shot of bourbon would hit the spot. How far do we have to go?" "It's only a short drive to the federal building, sir. We'll be there in a couple of minutes. In fact, you can see it right over there." He pointed to the tall glass slab rising over the East River, the building that once housed the United Nations headquarters. Cooper glanced briefly at the skyline of Manhattan. From the ground, it looked even more inhospitable than it had appeared from the air. The concrete towers were a far cry from the red adobe buildings of Santa Fe. Just looking at it made him feel claustrophobic. He had never been to New York City before. He'd been to Phoenix once, and that city had struck him as looking far too dense and sterile. This was even worse, and now he'd have to make his home here. As the limo cruised along FDR Drive, he sipped his bourbon and wondered for about the dozens of times since he left Santa Fe what he was letting himself in for. Only a few days ago, he had been working on a federally funded project at Los Alamos, dealing with psycho-cybernetics, a branch of science he had not been trained in, but which represented a unique opportunity for psychological research. He was trained as a psychiatrist, specializing in abnormal psychology and stress-related conditions. The Los Alamos Project, a branch of a government-sponsored study known as Project Download, had been concerned with the study of brain-computer interface, and he had been brought in to study the human aspect of the problem. The working conditions were, to say the least, a bit unusual. Most of his colleagues were on the research staff, and they were cybernetics engineers, which made for some interesting conversations over lunch in the project cafeteria and at dinner parties after work. As a group, engineers were not much given to abstract thinking, though cybernetics engineers were a bit more freewheeling and progressive in their attitudes. Most of them were fairly young, and they had a tendency to dress very casually in jeans, open-neck shirts, and sneakers. Many of the men wore their hair long and had beards. The women generally wore jeans and boots or denim skirts, plaid shirts, and sandals. Nobody ever wore a tie. His silver bolo was the only sort of neckwear in evidence. The atmosphere was less that of a government-sponsored project than a university lab. At first, he had felt very out of place. At 42, he was at least 10 years older than most of the other project staff, and he didn't understand 90% of what they were talking about. They had their own lingo, which sounded like Greek to him, and even their jokes went over his head. The only one he remembered understanding was the one about what you get when you cross a Jewish princess with a S-12 Mark V, a computer that never goes down. Even then, it took him about 10 seconds to get the punchline. To top things off, he was a Texan, which often made for strained social situations. For some reason that had always escaped him, people from the mountain states had always had a prejudice against Texans. Just as in the old days, before the war, there had been a certain provincial rivalry between the East and West Coasts, so people from states like New Mexico, Colorado, and Wyoming had a tendency to look down upon Texans. Perhaps it was because they bought up so much of their land. After the war, when Texas had seceded from what was left of the Union to form its own government with its capital in Dallas, things grew even worse. The country was in a terrible state. Washington, D.C. had been nuked into oblivion. The area for several hundred miles around it was still too hot to enter. New York had taken several missile strikes, as had Virginia, Boston, and the area around the Cape in Florida. But the majority of the missile strikes had occurred out west, in places like Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, Idaho, New Mexico, Utah, and Nevada. where most of the missile silos were. The strikes in California had triggered disastrous earthquakes, which, combined with the virus, had taken a cataclysmic toll in human life. Most of Nevada was one giant radioactive hotspot, its borders patrolled by federal troops. There were also hotspots in central and eastern Montana, in southern Idaho, northern Utah, throughout Wyoming, in eastern Colorado, and just north of Denver, as well as in Colorado Springs, which had been completely leveled. In New Mexico, the entire area around Alamogordo and White Sands practically glowed in the dark. The Jornada del Muerto, or Jornada del Muerto, was a vast that vast desert plain south of Socorro, running down to Hatch, was now truly the journey of death, and it's as its name implied. And the death toll brought about by the nuclear exchange was nothing compared to the loss of life caused by the virus. It had happened at the close of the 20th century, just as the new century was dawning. It was a dawn of death. Terrorists acting in the name of Islam had somehow gotten hold of a genetically engineered virus, a deadly organism created in a lab, no one knew where, by when, or by whom, and intending to bring the Western powers to their knees, they had released it simultaneously in many of the major cities of the world. However, they had vastly underestimated its virulence and the incredible speed with which it spread. Billions died within days of its release. The two major superpowers, each thinking the other was responsible, had immediately ordered retaliatory strikes, but only a small portion of their nuclear arsenals were ever actually launched. Even as the dreaded order was given, missile launch personnel keeled over at their posts as their fingers reached for the deadly buttons, leaving armed missiles still standing in their silos. Those that had not been destroyed were now inaccessible due to the radiation all around them. The entire human race might have easily died out if the virus had not undergone a rapid series of mutations. The first and second mutations were only a little less deadly than the original form. Those strains of the virus killed more slowly, attacking the nervous system, mysteriously sparing those lucky few who had somehow managed to acquire an immunity. The third mutation, known as Virus 3, while not immediately fatal, produced a carrier population called the Screamers, who were left mentally and physically ravaged by the disease. Within hours or even minutes of being infected, they became hopelessly insane, their bodies breaking out in painful, hideous, suppurating sores. The psychopathic Screamers would attack anything that moved, and most of those they came in contact with became infected like themselves. Because of this carrier population, Virus 3 was still a constant threat. There was no cure, and Screamers were always shot on sight. Virus 4, the next mutation, destroyed the myelin sheaths of the nerve fibers and left its victims crippled, their nerves and muscles gradually deteriorating as the disease progressed. The dreadful cycle finally came to an end when the virus was transformed into a comparatively harmless organism that posed a threat only to the old and weak, those whose immune systems no longer functioned properly. It brought on something like pneumonia, not fatal in itself, but enough to weaken the body and leave it open to further infection. The victims usually died of complications within 6 months to a year. By the time the awful cycle ran its course, the human population had been decimated, and most of the world had been reduced to anarchy. In what had once been the United States, the crippled government was woefully decentralized, with its headquarters in New York and bases in larger cities such as Boston, Philadelphia, Detroit, Chicago, and Atlanta. Florida had become a semi-independent state allied to the government, but Miami was a corrupt and freewheeling haven for pirates from the Gulf and the Caribbean, as well as every other sort of freebooter and hustler from Savannah to the Florida Keys. Most of the Southwest, with the exception of the larger cities, had regressed to the frontier lifestyle of the 1800s. Isolated pockets of civilization still existed in the northwestern states, but Nevada was a dead zone, and no one knew what was going on in what remained of California. There was no contact with either Alaska or Hawaii, and though Canada and Mexico had sustained no missile strikes, their death toll from the virus had been staggering, and the government of both countries had collapsed. In those places where there was no functioning authority, such as in much of the Midwest, the South, and in certain areas of the Northwest and the East Coast, independent enclaves had arisen, many of them controlled by powerful criminal organizations that operated with impunity and preyed upon neighboring cities. The military had its hands full protecting outlying provinces, upon which the cities depended for the food, and most of the cities were now war zones, with their paramilitary police forces working full-time to protect citizens from the savage predators in the ruins that surrounded them. In such a climate of disaster, the act of Texas in setting up its own independent government was regarded by many as treason. The Republic of Texas had not turned its back on the rest of the country, and it extended full cooperation to the beleaguered government of the United States, but the Texans' attitude in wanting to control their own destiny was something that infuriated many people. Consequently, when he came to Los Alamos, Dev Cooper expected to encounter problems, but aside from some good-natured ribbing, he was made to feel at home, and he regretted leaving. He also regretted giving up his work at Los Alamos, but the promise of a far more interesting and challenging assignment at Project Download headquarters in New York City had intrigued him. And in some ways, he had no choice. He had been selected, he was told, by the project director himself, Oliver Higgins, which had piqued his curiosity. He knew that Higgins was not a cybernetics engineer. In fact, he was not even a scientist. He was the government administrator for the project, which meant that he was CIA. And Dev Cooper, that meant his new assignment would be very interesting. All they had told him was that he would be working directly under Higgins at the Federal Building in New York, and the details of his job were classified. But they didn't have to tell him that the job was for him to make an educated guess. There's only one reason you could think of why they would want to bring a man with his qualifications to New York. He was being assigned to Project Steel, and that meant there was no way he could refuse. What psychiatrist could resist the temptation to be a therapist to a man with a computer for a brain? The results of Project Steel had only recently been released to the public, and though the actual details of the project were still classified, there wasn't anyone with access to a TV set who didn't know about Lieutenant Donovan Steele. The news had been broken by Channel 7 in New York, and every other station in the country had carried the story of the NYPD Strike Force officer who had become a cyborg. He had even seen news footage of Steele in action, and it was impressive, to say the least. Steele was a member of the Special Operations Division of the NYPD, more popularly known as the Strike Force, an elite police commando unit. Ambushed in the performance of his duties, Steele had been shot up so badly that it was a miracle he wasn't killed. The assassins had used fully automatic weapons loaded with armor-piercing and highly explosive rounds, against which his body armor and riot helmet had been scant protection. He arrived at the hospital in a coma, his brain irreparably damaged. The prognosis had been grim. He could be kept alive on life support, but he would remain a vegetable. However, shortly prior to being shot, Steele had participated in an experiment for Project Download. They had requested a member of the Strike Force as a test subject for a series of procedures to see if the knowledge and skills he had acquired as a police commando could be downloaded from his brain and programmed into a computer for transfer to other test subjects. To facilitate this, Steele had undergone surgery to install a biochip in his cerebral cortex that would enable him to interface with the project computers. After he was injured, he was brought to project headquarters where his shattered body was repaired with organ transplants, sophisticated Nysteel alloy prosthetics, and polymer skin grafts, a series of operations that reportedly took months. His still functioning implant enabled them to download the data engrams from his damaged brain and program them into a computer where they were debugged with data engrams downloaded from him previously during the experiments. When that procedure was completed, Steele's personality, his identity reduced to software, was programmed into a cybernetic brain that had been installed inside a Nysteel skull casing. The cybernetic unit was a prototype, the details of which were classified as top secret. No one at Los Alamos had known anything about it or had even suspected its existence. In the days prior to Dev's leaving for New York, it was all the project staff could talk about. They had inundated the project headquarters in New York with requests for transfers, and everyone he knew had handed him a resume, pleading with him to put in good word for them when he arrived. The grapevine buzzed with rumors, and everybody wanted to know about the cybernetic brain and how it was connected to Steele's human nervous system. But that wasn't what interested Dev Cooper. What Dev Cooper wanted to know about were the psychological effects on a man who came out of a coma to suddenly discover that he had a computer for a brain. A man who, by his own admission, still felt the same and thought the same, still had the same memories and sense of personal identity, but was plagued with the knowledge that his personality, or as he had put it, his soul, was contained in a computer. A man who, by his own admission, was no longer sure if he was human. He had a human heart beating in his chest, his lungs breathed air, and there was blood flowing throughout his veins, but his skeletal system had been reinforced with Nysteel, and there were a miniature fusion reactor in his chest cavity powering his electronics. His human cells still held the same genetic template, and he was capable of having children. But the essence of his self was contained in a sophisticated electronic circuitry. And how could that be considered human? What, Dev Cooper thought, must the man be feeling? A computer with emotions encased in flesh and blood. It was a staggering idea. How on earth could he be coping with it? The limo turned up on First Avenue and drove through the gates of the Federal Plaza. The flags of the United States, all save Texas, Dev noted, were fluttering from the flagpoles outside. They drove up to the entrance of what had been the UN Secretariat Building, which now housed the offices of the Congress of the United States, as well as a number of government agencies. The Congress itself was met in what had once been the General Assembly Building, the satellite structure connected to the Federal Building. An escort of Marines was waiting for him as he got out of the limo. They greeted him politely and very courteously walked him through the security checkpoint in the lobby, where his identity was verified and he was carefully searched. He noticed, with some sense of disquiet, the guards in the lobby, all armed with fully automatic weapons. After he was passed through the checkpoint, he was escorted to the elevators and up to the 22nd floor, where the first sight that greeted him as the elevator slid open was a shield of the Central Intelligence Agency mounted on the wall. "This way, please, doctor," one of the Marines said, conducting him down the hall past suites of offices to a black glass partition at the far end of the corridor. The gold letters on the wall read, "Project Steel." The Marine pressed a small button on the intercom, and a voice responded from the speaker.
Yes.
Dr. Devin Cooper to see Mr. Higgins.
Has the identity been verified?
The voice said. It has.
One moment, please.
Dev noticed a security camera mounted overhead, scanning him. He glanced up at it nervously.
Come right in, Dr. Cooper.
The door buzzed and opened electronically. Dev stepped through into a waiting room that looked like one in a corporate office. Gray pile flooring, chrome and black vinyl chairs, and a reception desk behind which sat a Marine sergeant in dress blues. Four other Marines stood around the room, at parade rest, each wearing a pistol and a white flap holster. The sixth man, in the reception area, was not in uniform. He was tall and slim, with dark hair graying at the temples, a cleft chin and alert, dark eyes. He looked to be in his mid-40s. He wore an elegantly tailored three-piece suit, dark gray with a fine charcoal stripe. His black shoes were highly polished, and his tie was a red silk fullered, perfectly knotted and held down with a small, tasteful gold stick pin. Button-down white shirt, French cuffs, with small gold cufflinks. Tasteful. Understated. He looked slightly amused as he took in Dev's Stetson. Shaggy brown hair and mustache. The western cut tweed sport coat. The bolo tie lowered below the open collar. The faded jeans and the elk-hide boots. "Well, howdy, partner," he said. Dev winced. "I'm Oliver Higgins. Welcome to New York." Higgins held out his hand. Dev took it and they shook. "Pleased to meet you, Mr. Higgins." "My office is just down the hall," said Higgins. "How was your flight?" "Okay, I guess," said Dev as they went down the hall. "Never did like flying much." "Well, we'll give you some time to rest before you plunge in. We've arranged for you to stay in a furnished apartment on Sutton Place, just a short walk from here. Nice area. Secure. They'll have you drop there after we're finished here. If there's anything you need, please don't hesitate to ask. I imagine you might want to pick up a few things." "Like a suit and tie, you mean?" said Dev. Higgins smiled. "Well, we don't exactly have a dress code here, but this isn't New Mexico. You might find yourself a bit conspicuous going about the city in those clothes, especially the hat. The cowboys in the city don't ride horses. You'll be assigned to an office and a secretary. She'll help you familiarize yourself with the city, and she can arrange for you anything you need. And I can recommend an excellent tailor who can provide you with a somewhat more regionally suitable wardrobe. The agency will pick up the tab, and you might want to get a haircut." "That a condition of my employment here?" asked Dev Riley. "Merely a suggestion," said Higgins. "If you want to look like Wild Bill Hickok, Doctor, it's no skin off my nose, but I'm not sure it's the image we'd like to project." "Well, I wouldn't want to rock the boat," said Dev, "and I guess I could use some extra clothes. I only brought one suitcase. Mind if I keep the boots?" "By all means, keep the boots," said Higgins with a smile. "We wouldn't want you to feel uncomfortable." "Appreciate it." Higgins opened the door to his office and they went inside. Dev looked around at the plush brown carpeting, the large mahogany desk, the wood paneling, and the bar situated in the corner. There was a large console on the wall containing no fewer than 10 video display screens. "Nice," he said. "Thank you," Higgins said. "Sit down. Drink?" "Don't mind if I do," said Dev as he sat down in a leather upholstered armchair by the desk. "Bourbon on the rocks, right?" Higgins said. "That in my file?" Dev asked, raising his eyebrows. "Oh, everything is in your file, Doctor," Higgins said, walking over to the bar. "That a fact?" "Oh, we like to be thorough," Higgins said as he poured their drinks. He took scotch for himself, straight up. "There isn't much about you we don't know. You're an expert horseman. You hunt, and you're a crack shot with both rifle and pistol. You collect guns, and you have a special fondness for revolvers, particularly old single-action 45s. You have an IQ of 197. You're apolitical. You read philosophy, and you're a student of Western history. You wrote your thesis on post-traumatic stress disorder in the aftermath of the Biowar. I read it. I thought it was cogently written, concise, well-researched, and thought out. You were married at 19, divorced at 20 because your wife discovered she wasn't quite ready to settle down with one man. No children, no desire to have any. Both parents dead, no living relatives. You're a workaholic. You drink a bit excessively, but you hold your liquor well. You don't smoke, you don't use drugs, although you've experimented with them in the past. And I understand you play a mean game of poker." He handed Dev his drink. "We'll have to play sometime," said Dev. My game is chess, said Higgins. However, I don't think I'm in your league. Unlike you, I actually need to have a board in front of me. Dev smiled. You've done your homework. I always do, said Higgins, sitting down behind his desk. I imagine you've surmised why you're here. I've been assigned to Project Steel, said Dev. Higgins nodded. You'll be taking the place of Dr. Susan Carmody on the project staff, he said. Why did Dr. Carmody leave? Asked Dev. She didn't, said Higgins curtly. She was killed. I'm sorry to hear that, Dev said. Was it a job-related accident? Not directly, no, said Higgins. She got in the line of fire when an assassination attempt was made on Lieutenant Steele. Assassination attempt? Said Dev, frowning. Lieutenant Steele is a federal officer attached to Strike Force, Higgins said. In the course of his duties, he'd made some powerful enemies, notably one Victor Borodini, head of a large crime syndicate with headquarters in Cold Spring Harbor on the north shore of Long Island. We've been having problems with the Borodini Enclave for quite some time. He controls half of the street gangs in No Man's Land, the area surrounding Midtown. Where we are now, the street gangs are, to all intents and purposes, the law in No Man's Land, and Borodini provides them with arms and drugs, among other things. In return, he takes a cut of all their operations. Why don't you send the troops in and take care of him? Asked Dev. It's not as simple as that, said Higgins. For one thing, we can't really spare the troops. The city depends on the outlying provinces and areas like upstate New York and New Jersey for its supplies, and we need the troops there to protect them. Aside from that, the Borodini Enclave is extremely well fortified and defended. They've got radar and surface-to-air missiles capable of taking out any choppers before they can even get within range. A ground assault would require at least a full division to be successful. Unfortunately, that would be politically unfeasible. Why is that? The criminal enclaves on Long Island represent the only functioning authority out there, Higgins explained. There are five principal enclaves: Borodini's, the Delano Enclave in Brooklyn, the Pastore family in Queens, the Castellanos in Long Beach, and the Brood, a large and heavily armed biker gang out in Montauk on the eastern tip of the island. Each enclave has a citizen population under its control, people who've had no choice but to turn to them for protection and a livelihood. The Brood, in particular, controls a large civilian population that makes up the agrarian communities in eastern Long Island and the fishing fleets along the shore. Any kind of assault on the enclaves would consequently result in a significant loss of innocent civilian life. We don't have the military manpower, and the police here in the city have their hands full as it is. Up until now, the enclaves haven't presented a really significant problem due to their rivalries, but Borodini has become the most powerful of the Long Island crime lords, and he wants nothing less than full control of the city. If something isn't done about him soon, he might well get it. How does Lieutenant Steele fit in? Asked Dev. He's got a personal score to settle with Victor Borodini, Higgins said. It was Borodini's men who ambushed him and nearly killed him. We can't get to Borodini where he lives, but we can do everything we can to disrupt his operations in the city. And that's where Steele comes in? Asked Dev. Exactly, Higgins said. I've turned him loose on the street gangs backed by Borodini. As a federal officer, he's not hampered by bureaucratic regulations governing the strike force, and he's free to hit and run, conducting urban guerrilla tactics against them. Our goal is to interfere with Borodini's operations enough to weaken him and make him vulnerable to the Delano family, which is the second most powerful enclave aside from the Brood. But the Brood doesn't really represent a threat to us. They're essentially self-sustaining, dealing with the enclaves for necessities they can't produce themselves. They don't conduct any criminal operations in the city, and if so long as they leave us alone, we don't really care what they do. So, Steele disrupts Borodini's operations in the city, and Borodini sends his soldiers after him, said Dev. He grimaced. Sounds to me like you sent him out there to be a target. Precisely. Sort of a field test of his capabilities. Is that it? Dev said. And if the prototype performs up to expectations, you get the funds to build yourself more cyborgs? Higgins smiled. I see you grasp the situation, Doctor. Building Steele is expensive. Consequently, the government wants to be certain we've perfected him before they allocate more funds for additional cyborgs. But they're extremely invested in what we're doing. Think what it could mean to have cyborg units in every major city. One of them could do the work of an entire assault team. With cyborg units attached to the military, we could free up a lot of manpower, enabling us to take some positive steps to bring back law and order and pull this country back together. I see, said Dev. And how does Lieutenant Steele feel about all this? He's holding up, said Higgins, but he's had some difficulty in adjusting to the situation. That will be where you come in, Doctor. I can take care of his physical maintenance, but it will be your job to take care of his emotional stability. I'm no cybernetics engineer, said Dev. I'm not qualified to debug computer programs. I know that, Higgins said. We've got plenty of people on the project staff for that, but they're specialists in artificial intelligence, not human intelligence. And we're breaking into totally new ground here. Steele's brain is a computer with a human personality. There's never been such a thing before. We've never had a computer with emotions. Consequently, we need a first-rate psychotherapist to work with Steele and supervise our cybernetic engineers and program adjustments that might be necessary. Your qualifications in that field are beyond reproach. What you have done will do here will lay the groundwork for the science of psycho-cybernetics for years to come. I think you'll find this the most challenging and stimulating task of your career. I have no doubt of that, said Dev. But my main question is just how much autonomy will I have? Like you said, we're talking about breaking entirely new ground here. For me to do my job right, I need enough freedom to feel my way around. And if Steele's going to be my patient, that means my first responsibility will be to him. I can see where things could get a little sticky. I'm not sure I understand, said Higgins, frowning. Well, let me put it this way, Dev said. Under normal circumstances, the doctor-patient relationship would be extremely confidential. But then, these aren't exactly ordinary circumstances, are they? Frankly, I got no idea what the law would say on this point. But let's set the law aside for the sake of this discussion and simply cut to the chase. I could say that my patient is a human being entitled to full civil rights and confidentiality of the treatment. On the other hand, you could say that he's a computer. A computer, and my job is to simply fix up any little glitches that might happen to crop up. Now we could go back and forth about what that means until the cows come home, but the fact is you already have access to his data engrams, and I imagine you can run a download on him anytime you like. So suppose something happens to him that you think requires some sort of adjustment to the program, but I think it would constitute a violation of my patient's rights and a threat to the integrity of his personality. What happens then? An excellent question, Dr. Higgins said. Allow me to set your mind at ease on that score. On the question of doctor-patient confidentiality, you're quite correct in assuming that we can pull a download on Steele anytime we choose. However, I'm not really interested in knowing the specifics of what the two of you might discuss in private. My only concern when it comes to that is Steele's emotional stability. And quite frankly, I would prefer that to be handled in traditional therapeutic manner rather than making alterations to his programming, which would be very complicated and only a last resort. The details of this project are classified, he continued, but we do have a highly visible profile, and the media would have a field day with the issue of cybernetic mind control. We're coming in for a certain amount of flack on that already, as I'm sure you must know for your work at Los Alamos. Consequently, when it comes to maintaining the integrity of Steele's personality, you will have full and absolute authority. You have my personal guarantee on that. You will attend to all operational conference meetings. No alterations will be made to Steele's programming without your consent. Express written consent. Steele is a cyborg, not a robot. We're not interested in altering his personality in any way. We just want to make sure he stays healthy. Mean and no offense, said Dev. But would you mind letting me have that in writing? Higgins raised his eyebrows. You're a careful man, Doctor. Well, as we say down in Texas, said Dev, an oral agreement ain't worth the paper it's written on. Higgins smiled. All right, I will have a signed statement to that effect drawn up for you. Will that be satisfactory? I appreciate that, said Dev. In that case, Doctor, welcome aboard. Thanks. When do I get to meet my patient? First thing in the morning, if you like, said Higgins, but I thought you might want to familiarize yourself with the file first. Yes, I'd like that. Could I look it over tonight? What time would be convenient? What time? I can't allow it to leave the premises, says Higgins, but I can give you security access to it through the terminal in your apartment. I cannot, of course, allow you to pull a copy, but you can examine it as much as you like, anytime you like, providing request clearance in a secure line first. You're a careful man yourself, said Dev, but I can understand the reason for it. Would 7 o'clock sharp be all right? I'll arrange it, Higgins said. And now, perhaps you'd like to see your office and meet your new secretary? If either doesn't meet with your approval, please let me know at once. Then perhaps you'd care to join me for lunch? Thanks. I could do with a bite to eat. I didn't have time for breakfast. Is there any place a man can get himself some good huevos rancheros? What's that? Asked Higgins. Never mind, said Dev. I'll sell for some steak and eggs.